Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I'll be your host for the next 90 minutes. This is another in our series, Drugs, Death, and Destruction, a look at the drug situation in America today. Last week, our focus was more on the legal aspect. Lawyer Mitch Stone discussed the current legal climate. This week, we're going to be looking at another facet, addiction recovery. Joining me on the panel is author Armando Aldazabar. Armando has two very drug-centric novels in print. Armando, welcome to the show.
Hey, Simon. How are you? Hello, everybody.
Also joining us is Dr. Michael Provence, COO of two drug treatment centers in Florida. Good afternoon, Dr. Provence, and thank you so much for taking time out to talk with us today.
Good afternoon, Simon and Armando.
I do want to let our listeners know that our switchboard is open, and we welcome your questions and comments. Our number is area code 646-378-1120. Also, our chat room is open, and you're welcome to ask your questions in there, and we will be monitoring it. Dr. Provence, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit about what your group does?
Certainly. In Jacksonville, Florida, we operate two drug treatment facilities. One is Lakeview Health Systems, the other is Stepping Stone Center for Recovery. Both facilities essentially offer the same type of treatment, and it's really a multidisciplinary approach to drug and alcohol treatment as well as dual diagnosis. In saying that we have a multidisciplinary approach, what that means is from a medical, psychiatric, social perspective as well as a 12-step perspective and therapy.
I see. Last week, we had attorney Mitch Stone on the panel. Mitch specializes in drug-related cases. In fact, he was telling us that something like 70 or 80% of the cases he handles are connected in some fashion with drugs, whether it be street drugs or prescription drugs. And he made an interesting observation about trends. He told us that cocaine seems to be trending down. Meth and crack were basically holding steady. But the big upswing was in cases pertaining to prescription drugs, pharmacists that were illegally selling them, patients stealing prescription pads, things like that. Are you seeing the same trend from the recovery aspect?
Absolutely. We've seen exactly the same trend here. I think the DEA would also agree with you. They're very aware that this is an uprising problem in the drug community. What I can tell you is it's probably less common theft of the drugs, but more common in terms of either writing your own prescription or calling it in, or also doctor shopping, which has become illegal in many states. One thing that some of the states have done to curb this is that the pharmacies have computer connections with each other, and I have, in the last year, admitted several patients who have been arrested for doctor shopping. What we're seeing is that OxyContin is probably the most commonly abused prescription drug, followed by benzodiazepines such as Xanax, Clonopin, Ativan. And many times these medications are prescribed by one or more physicians.
How on earth do people afford to fill these prescriptions? I mean, drugs are not cheap.
Well, I can tell you that it happens by two modalities. One is insurance. Many patients have insurance and they fill the medications. And the other is through private pay, getting money from a family member. But many of these patients are able to work and function on these medications for a period of time. So they're gainfully employed. They choose to spend their money on these substances rather than other things. And then the other is, I think if you're buying these drugs on the street, they become quite costly.
Right.
Oftentimes patients will fill a prescription, and although they're not using the drugs themselves, they do sell it to their friends, neighbors, or somebody else on the street for a premium.
Years ago, when you mentioned the word addiction, what sprang to mind immediately was alcohol. Is alcohol still the prime addiction, or is drugs sort of taken over?
I have to say that I would. My feeling is alcohol still is very high on the list, if not the number one substance that I see patients addicted to. But oftentimes it's in combination with other substances. But certainly it's not overwhelming. There are a good portion of our patients who come in with straight drug dependence as well.
What about age groups? Is one age group more prevalent than the other to a specific drug, if you will? What's your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts on that are that when you're talking about age groups, it has to be substance-specific. The morbidity and mortality that you get from alcohol dependence and the social consequences tend to come later in life. It progresses somewhat slower. So the patients that we see that get treated for alcohol dependence oftentimes are in their mid-30s all the way up to 50 for a first treatment. And that's not to say that we don't have younger folks that have gotten a DUI or had some significant problems from alcohol. In terms of opiates, I would like to say that what we're seeing is younger and younger patients addicted to opiates, namely OxyContin, much less likely to be an illegal drug like heroin. And those patients, we treat patients from the age of 18 up, so that's what I can speak to, and oftentimes 18, 19, 20, 22, 23 is what we're seeing for that in terms of a bigger kind of age group. In terms of cocaine, methamphetamine, benzodiazepines, it tends to be a mid-range, anywhere from mid-20s up to 40s for a first treatment.
Wow. Armando, you're very quiet this afternoon.
I was just listening in. Actually, I do have a question for you, Dr. Provines. And that is, do you believe that tolerance to a drug and physical dependence is a defining characteristic of addiction?
I do believe that it is one of the defining characteristics, but for me, more importantly, we have to separate physical dependence from addiction. And the differentiation is that you can have a cancer patient, for example, who's on pain medications, and because of their pain and the severity, they may have developed a tolerance based on the duration of use, and they may require higher doses of that medication. So that patient is physically dependent, but what you don't see in that patient that you do see in an addicted patient is you have social consequences. The patients who are treated for pain don't typically obtain their substances from multiple doctors. They don't increase the dose on their own. They don't use it in routes that aren't prescribed, such as smoking, chewing it, injecting it. They tend to not have relationship problems, work problems, and other things. So to me, that is one of the defining characteristics of addiction, is the consequences and the ability to manage the use.
And go ahead.
I was just going to say, oftentimes when a patient is prescribed a pain medication, and I'm using that as a specific example for pain, and using it appropriately, they tend not to get addicted as much as someone who decides the first time they're using it for a recreational purpose.
Right.
And that's not to say that pain patients don't in the end up with addiction. Many of them do.
Right. And that was my point, because I asked, because I know someone personally with severe chronic pain, and they're taking opiates, and he tells me the only way for him to, I guess, maintain a relieving pain effect, you know, he has to continually increase his dose.
Right, and one of the differentiations.
How does he recover?
One of the differentiations between an addict and a patient who's using the substance appropriately is that the patient has pain. They call their doctor. The doctor increases the dose or changes the medication or the frequency.
Suicide is a subject that or a word that's often associated with drug use. And there's really two sides to that coin. There's suicide from depression, which is caused by the drug usage, and there's, I guess you would call it, accidental suicide by excessive drug use. Drugs and mental illness seem to be very close bedfellows.
Yes, I would agree with that.
Okay, that was short and sweet.
No, I wanted to go into it a little bit. I think that it's really very difficult, and like I said, we treat patients with a multidisciplinary approach, so oftentimes we're not able to determine what came first, whether it was psychiatric or substance. And in the end, I don't know that it matters that much. What matters is that the patient comes in and they have a psychiatric disorder as well as a chemical dependence disorder. And from day one, both need to be treated simultaneously. I know you touched on suicide, and you know, certainly patients who have psychosocial stressors in their life, such as marital discord, problems with relationship, work problems, tend to be more depressed, and depression obviously is one of the precursors to a suicide attempt or actually a successful suicide. The other thing that happens is you touched on accidental overdoses, and what I see is that that tends to occur much more with opiates than with other substances such as alcohol and benzos. And what happens is a patient oftentimes doesn't understand their tolerance level. When you're buying drugs off the street, you're not necessarily sure of the purity if you change a drug dealer or if the drug dealer gets the substance from a different source and it's more pure. You're used to using, let's say, 3 bags of heroin or 4 or 5, and you use the same dosage. The drug that they're using, if it's more pure, they certainly can have an overdosage as well. The other common scenario is that the patient is using a drug and then they add another drug to it. Their friend comes over and they have a different substance, such as they were using opiates and now they have a benzo and they add it to the mix. And that can also lead to an accidental overdose.
Mm. Well, one of the treatments that is used is methadone. Is it effective, or are you merely trading one addiction for another?
Well, what I can say is it depends on the patient, and it also depends on the clinic and the prescribing physician and how much associated treatment that patient's given. I have seen patients that are taking methadone for 5, 10, 15 years. They're functioning appropriately. Their lives are back together. They're not obtaining it through illegal sources. They're able to work. And then there are also people who buy methadone and use it illicitly, or clinics that are prescribing it to patients in high doses that they don't necessarily need. I do want to say that methadone and the indication is opioid dependence. So if a patient is on methadone and they're still committing crime, or they have difficulties with work or at home, or they're still homeless, it doesn't necessarily mean the methadone isn't working for what it's prescribed for, which is opioid dependent. They may not be using heroin anymore, and they may not be getting methadone from illicit sources, but it was never intended to treat cocaine dependence, for example. So I think we have to look at that. But certainly I think that the controls that are placed on methadone need to be followed carefully, and patients who continue to have problems with recurrent relapses maybe aren't appropriate for methadone. It's not been effective.
Not in clinical terms, but what does methadone do? Does it give the user a high, or does it just remove the craving for the opiate?
I can answer that in 3 different ways. The first way is methadone is an opiate, just like heroin is, just like hydrocodone, oxycontin. It acts in similar ways. It binds to the same receptors, so it does relieve pain, number one. Number two, it causes sedation. And number three, you certainly can get a euphoric, meaning a high, from the methadone, but it tends to not be the same feeling. If you give different substances to addicts, they tend to prefer one over the other based on the euphoric effects, and methadone is lower on the list than some of the other opiates. The other thing that methadone does is because of its binding properties to receptors, and I know you asked me not to get clinical, if you have questions.
No, it's fine, you know.
All right. That it tends to block some of the other opiates, so if a patient's using methadone and other opiates, it may block some of the euphoric effects, although it's very dangerous in practice in terms of what we recently spoke about, which is overdosage. But it works a little bit differently. It has a long half-life, but again, it is an opiate. It's a Schedule II controlled substance like the other opiates. Most of the other opiates are also in Schedule II for DEA.
When you say it has a long half-life, I know more about atomic energy than I do about drugs. But I presume what you mean is that you can give methadone, and those receptors will remain blocked for a longer period of time than, let's say, a hit of an opiate.
A different opiate, right. That is exactly the case. The other good thing about it having a long half-life is that if you're going to a methadone clinic, you need to go once a day. You don't have to go two or three or four times a day. So, you know, the duration of action is and it stays in the body for a long period of time. And when a drug does that, it tends to not be as euphoric as some of the other drugs because of the dosing of the medication.
I don't want to get into too much clinical talk, but when you prescribe methadone, Do you gradually try and weaken the dosage over time? Is that the plan?
Well, there's two different ways, actually three. One is for pain, and that's not what we're discussing here, but you can use it for pain, and that may be an increase or decrease based on the pain. What we're discussing is drug addiction. Methadone is used for detoxification, and if a patient is coming into a facility or even an outpatient for detox, it'll start. The medication may start at a lower dose. They'll taper it up until the patient doesn't have symptoms, and then that medication will be tapered down over a period of time. It can be over a week or a month or 2 months, depending on what the plan is. If a patient is going on methadone for maintenance, they tend to start at a certain dosage, generally 30 to 60 milligrams, and that dosage is tapered up based on the patient's symptoms until the patient is wide awake, able to function, and yet not having cravings. And that dosage varies widely between any individual patient. I mean, there's a huge range of that dosage.
I have a comment. Actually, Dr. Provance, I'd like to get your opinion on this. And this is touching back to what Mitch Stone said. In other countries right now, Mexico actually just picked up on this. They're using the actual drug to detox the patient versus the substitute drug, like methadone. Instead of using methadone, they're actually giving the addict heroin and diluting each dose till, I guess, the addict becomes independent from it.
Well, certainly we're not doing that in this country. And heroin does have a long half-life, so it certainly could be used for detoxification. I do know in Europe, and specifically England, that heroin is a legal substance prescribed for pain, and I believe they're also using it for detoxification. The one thing I would say about that is using the same drug for detoxification is that oftentimes the drugs have, and we touched on having a long or short half-life, is when a drug has a short half-life, what you're dealing with is the patient takes the medication, they feel better, they start to go into withdrawal. When they go under that threshold, you have to dose the medication again. So what you get is a cyclic effect, and the patient doesn't tend to feel as well as they do when you give a medication with a long half-life where they're not going into withdrawal three or four times a day.
You mentioned that the clinics you're involved in take a multidimensional approach. You also mentioned 12-step. I've talked to a number of people. In fact, I spent 6 years working out of a homeless shelter. And, you know, the 12-step program was very much the in thing, if you will. We didn't have the medical intervention that, you know, that was the only thing we could offer. How do you feel about the 12-step program versus medical intervention, or do you require both?
Well, in our facility, we require both because that's how we're set up, and I can tell you there's no right answer to that. You have to look at the individual patient. There may be an area of the country, and I've had this experience with patients, where they have to drive an hour and a half to get to a meeting. That becomes difficult. Although in this day and age, if they have computer access, there are online meetings for the 12 steps. In terms of the 12 steps, I think it really is very helpful for patients who have started using drugs at a young age or even at an older age and have not developed the ability to have healthy relationships. And in the 12 steps, you're going to find a whole variety of different types of people from all walks of life, and connecting with other people who are sober and being able to not only go to the rooms with the patient, with the other, with your fellows, but also go out to other social events and kind of build a life around that. Many of our patients only have friends who are, or family members who are also using substances or who are not healthy. So getting in a healthy environment, making those kind of relationships, I think is important. The other piece is it's kind of a, you know, whether you're a drug addict or not, if you're addicted to substances or you have a mental health issue, the 12 steps is a simple blueprint to living a healthy lifestyle, and I think, you know, anybody really can use it. Not every step will apply to every person, but in general, I think most people can get something out of most of the steps. In terms of medical intervention, I think it's absolutely essential that a patient have exposure to that. There are medications that we can use for chemical dependence and also obviously psychiatric disorders. So I think that those two pieces are critical. If a patient does decide not to go to a 12-step program, there are other programs out there such as Rational Recovery and or continued outpatient care with either a therapist or an aftercare group, which I think is essential. So whatever ends up happening with the patient, they need to be in some type of support group when they leave treatment, whether it be through medical intervention, therapy, aftercare groups, or a 12-step program, Rational Recovery. There's a lot of options.
We had a guest on last week. He's an author, Carlton Davis. And he also is a recovering crack addict. And the 12-step program came up, and he made a really interesting comment. He said, well, it obviously didn't work for me. I tried it several times. Carlton is also bipolar, but I'm going to come back to the bipolar aspect a little bit later.
Sure.
What changed it all around for him was getting the right medication for his bipolar disorder, and he claims, and I have no reason to doubt him, that as soon as the correct sort of cocktail of medication was stumbled upon, he had no urge to use crack anymore.
Mm-hmm. What you may be dealing with in that situation is a patient who's been self-medicating. And I do use the term patient instead of chemically dependent person. I'm just referring to anybody, whether they've been under medical care or not. But what you may be dealing with, or he may have been dealing with, is self-medication, which does happen. Patients who are depressed or, like you mentioned, have bipolar disorder or anxiety, and you tend to see certain subsets of chemical dependence related to certain subsets of psychiatric disorders. There's a wide variation in that, but there tends to be some trends in terms of which types of psychiatric disorders and or personalities choose which types of substances. And bipolar is one that you see a wide variety. You either see sedatives or you also see stimulants.
Actually, the bipolar population is an interesting one. As I said, I worked out of a very large homeless shelter. We house something like 1,100 people every night. I was not at the sharp end, if you will. I actually ran a computer learning center.
Okay.
But I met a number of bipolar sufferers, and they were more than happy to, you know, tell me that, oh yeah, I'm bipolar. And there were two common threads. One was, by and large, they all had some sort of artistic bent, whether it be painting or you know, maybe even writing. And the other one was they were all drug addicts. I mean, the two just seemed to go hand in hand. Bipolar must be on drugs. I mean, I know that's painting with a very broad brush. What's your experience been with the bipolar sufferers?
Sure. I just want to clarify. This was a homeless shelter you were working at?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. One of the things that we have to clarify here is that the population that you were dealing with was a certain subset of the general population, and that was homelessness. So drug addiction either can lead to homelessness, or homelessness can lead to drug addiction, as well as psychiatric disorders can lead to homelessness. So I want to just preface this by saying that with that population, certainly being homeless, having bipolar, and having access to other substances that make you feel better is not, you know, it's not a stretch to think that someone would try that and get addicted to the substance. I can tell you that outside of that population and even within it, there are a lot of people who have bipolar disorder who have never touched an illegal substance or are not addicted to substances. So it's really about which viewpoint you're looking at and which subset of population. But that goes without saying that patients with severe psychiatric disorders have a higher prevalence of drug addiction than people who don't have psychiatric disorders.
Right. In fact, the subset that I worked with, we had a survey done on our behalf, and basically we discovered that about one-third of our, you know, quote, population had some kind of psychiatric issue. One-third suffered from one of the big three addictions, and that being alcohol, drugs, and believe it or not, gambling.
Mm-hmm.
And the gamblers were always easy to spot. The gamblers were reasonably well-kept. You know, they looked after their image. They almost always had some form of steady employment. In fact, I kind of made friends with one gentleman. He was a heavy equipment operator.
Uh-huh.
You know, good job, earned great money, got paid, you know, every other Friday, and every other Saturday he was completely flat broke. He would take his paycheck to the casino, and he wouldn't leave until it was gone. Yeah, he was a functioning worker, but just could not get a grip on this gambling urge. Is gambling something that your clinics handle as well, or not?
We don't actually treat gambling addiction. I have treated a gambling addiction in the past, but it's not something that I have a lot of experience with. What I can tell you is that gambling addiction and addictions such as internet pornography and video games are called process addictions, and it's thought that they do affect the brain in a different way than the chemical addictions that we've been talking about. But certainly when you see a patient, and I'm going to go back to drugs for a moment, when you see a patient addicted to drugs, they do what they need to do in their life to protect that addiction and to be able to have a source of those drugs. And oftentimes it turns to either selling drugs and then keeping a portion of it for yourself, Some patients do maintain their employment, and that's how they're able to obtain their drug. And some patients spend all day going to different doctors. What I can tell you about gambling is, in order for those people who are addicted to gambling to maintain that addiction, they have to have a source of income. And by not continuing employment, they're not going to be able to continue to gamble. So I think that they have a lot of motivation to continue their employment. The other thing I will say is that they do oftentimes have some of the same social consequences. One of the obviously financial relationship problems with their spouse or their family is another one high on the list, and the other one is you know, social consequences in terms of employment. Eventually, if you're in the casino all night and you have to get up and go to work, or you're gambling at work online, a lot of gambling is online now, and you're spending 4 hours a day at work gambling, it can in the end affect that, and that's when those patients tend to seek treatment. It happens to generally occur at a slower pace or rate, if you will, than chemical addiction.
Right. Regardless of what the addiction is, recovery costs money. How do we fund the recovery efforts? Do you think that the government should step up to the plate and put more money into recovery, or should the government step up to the plate and do more in the way of prevention?
I can answer that in a couple of different aspects. First of all, obviously, my opinion, and I'm in the field, is that we need funds to be able to treat patients who don't have resources to obtain treatment. The other is getting some kind of parity with insurance companies. And by parity, I mean that if they cover a certain amount of treatment for medical disorders, having parity with that for chemical dependence. Some insurance companies have a different benefit for chemical dependence than they do for other medical disorders, and chemical dependence certainly has been clearly defined as a medical disorder. In terms of being able to not get recovered if you don't have funds, that's not always the case, although it makes it much easier because the 12-step groups are free, and I've seen many people get sober in the 12-step groups without going to treatment. So if you're trying to get into a state-funded, if anybody's listening and you're trying to get into a state-funded facility, you don't have insurance, you don't have funds, there's no reason why you can't stop by a 12-step meeting and try to start your recovery there. Obviously, if you're using a drug such as alcohol or sedatives where the withdrawal could be medically dangerous, you need to present yourself to an emergency room before you stop using substances. But resources are limited in this day and age for the treatment of chemical dependence.
Actually, one of the problems, I think, and you know, it's a bit of a guess, is that medical insurance has become a little bit of a hot topic over the last few years. Insurance companies canceling policies for, you know, one reason or another, as soon as they discover some pre-existing condition, oops, you're out. You know, even though you've been faithfully making your payments. I've got a feeling that a lot of people are scared to seek help because of what might happen to their medical insurance.
Mm-hmm. I've not seen that particularly. What I have seen is that people are afraid to seek help based on utilizing their insurance because they have a fear that their employers or their spouse or someone else will find out about their treatment through their insurance, because in order to access insurance and have it pay for your treatment, you do need to notify the insurance company, and oftentimes they have a whole wealth of information on the patient, very specific confidential information. I have seen patients have that fear. In terms of canceling a policy, it's generally written into a policy if there's a pre-existing on the policy. If there's not a pre-existing on the policy, there's a lot of laws that protect consumers. in terms of wrongful cancellation of insurance, and there are methods and avenues that the patient can utilize in order to maintain that insurance.
Right. You mentioned a very, very salient fact that people may be worried that their employer will discover and they're going to end up without a job. Is that based on fact, or is it just people's fears? Is it possible for an employer to delve into his employees' medical records?
Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of got a long answer for that, I guess. First of all, if a patient comes to treatment, they utilize their insurance, and they need time off from work, there's something called the Federal Family and Medical Leave Act, and that affords you, if your company meets certain criteria, they're required by law for medical or family emergencies, to give you up to 12 weeks off in a calendar year after you've worked for the company with a certain number of hours for a period of 12 months. And on that form, it requires a diagnosis. Oftentimes that form goes to a human resources department.
Mm.
So if you're working for General Motors, who has hundreds of thousands of employees, that probably the information is fairly secure. But if you're working for a company that has 50 employees and the HR director is also a manager of another department and they're, more familiar with it, oftentimes that information can get out. It's not supposed to. The other thing is, if you have short-term or long-term disability benefits through your employer, that paperwork also gets turned in for that claim, so your human resources department is aware of that diagnosis. And I have seen people lose their jobs. Alcohol dependence is covered under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and there are protections against that. But the bottom line is, if your employer doesn't want you to work there, they find ways to make that happen. And I guess the main thing is, and I would ask the listeners to think about this, if your neighbor has diabetes, how do you feel about that? If you hear that your neighbor has an addiction to crack cocaine, do you have different feelings about that? I think at some point we have to look at addiction as a medical disease, and and we've made tremendous progress over the last 30 years, more over the last 20 or 25, but looking at a disease as something different is really, it's about changing perceptions, and when that happens, I don't think you would be so likely to get terminated from your employment for seeking treatment. Although I will say, for employers, if you have a patient or an employee who's out over and over again and comes to work late, those are the consequences of this addiction, and employers need someone to come to work on time.
Oh, indeed.
Do you think the legalization of drugs would increase, would help to go more further into medical treatment and to treat the addict, or do you think that's a dead end?
I can't really answer to that in terms of data, true data. What I can say is my personal opinion is that would open a whole host of problems for our country. It may work in other societies or other cultures, and I think it has successfully. But, in talking to people, I've had extensive travel in my background, and different cultures react to chemical dependence and have a prevalence of chemical dependence that vary widely. And the United States tends to be very high on the list. There are other countries that you go to that are very low on the list, and that's not to say that it doesn't happen all over the world, but it also tends to be, addiction is a genetic disease. It's also influenced, and it's an environmental disease. And I think in this country, it tends to be more prevalent. And because of that, I don't know that legalization would be the right route in this country.
Actually, Armando dug this up about 10 days ago, that Mexico has just passed a new law. Armando, tell us about this new law.
Well, their law is, I guess, being more lenient on drug charges. You're allowed to carry 5 grams of marijuana with you, 1 gram of cocaine, and 21 milligrams of heroin. But as I was digging further into that, they're trying to go the same route as like Amsterdam is or whatnot. They're trying to actually use this as a way to treat the addicts through, you know, medical treatment and to go from there.
Well, that opens a couple of questions. I don't know if you know, and I don't know that anybody knows that that law was passed based on financial concerns in terms of having an arrest, having to process the person
right.
through the criminal justice system and then incarceration. That's very costly. My guess is it had something to do with that because of the amounts that you're allowed to carry. Or was it a decision based totally on treatment? And I think that would be answered by, you know, once we see arrests in Mexico, are these people treated or are they just let go? So, you know, certainly it could have been made for a variety of reasons.
I want to jump in really quickly and just say to our listeners that our switchboard is open. Our number is area code 646-378-1120. And we would love to hear your questions and comments. Joining us this week on the panel is Dr. Michael Provence, and he is without doubt an expert on the subject of addictions. So pick up the phone and give us a call. Michael, do you see high levels of recidivism?
Certainly. That's part of this disease. I know people who have gone to treatment 12 times and eventually gotten sober. I know people who have gone to treatment one time and gotten sober. And I know people who have gone to the 12 steps and gotten sober there. But recidivism is part of this disease. And just like, and I made an analogy earlier to diabetes, you have your blood sugar under control and it gets out of control and you have to adjust your insulin or whatever medication you're on. The same thing happens with this disease. It's chronic. It's progressive. It tends to worsen over time. For those people who are able to maintain solid recovery, I can tell you that the longer you have since your last drink or drug, the better chance you have of maintaining sobriety. But there are people who have been sober for many, many years who relapse. It's about being vigilant and continuing to take care of yourself throughout the rest of your life. The other thing I'll say about recidivism is that it's also drug dependent, meaning that you see less with certain substances and more with others. I would say opioids, you see a very high rate of recidivism.
Is the teen population increasing, you know, these more now nowadays than before as far as addiction and
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Is the teenage population increasing more these last recent years than before as far as addiction is concerned?
Well, in terms of absolute numbers or percentages, I can't answer that question, but I do believe
the personal thing.
I believe the substances that young people are using are different. I think obviously you know, years ago it was alcohol. It switched to marijuana and then maybe cocaine. And again, what we're seeing a lot of now is opioids. And opioids tend to be to have a strong physiologic dependence with a very strong drive to continue to use. So I would say in terms of making the diagnosis of chemical dependence rather than chemical abuse, that it probably has increased because of that, because of the opioids.
Go ahead, Doctor.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say I believe that being able to make a formal diagnosis probably has increased based on the change in the drug of choice of teenagers at this point.
You mentioned chemical abuse versus chemical dependence. Is there a difference?
Well, there's a medical diagnostic difference between chemical dependence and chemical abuse or substance abuse. And one of the major differences, and Armando, you touched on this earlier, is physiologic tolerance, needing more of the drug to produce the same effect and having a withdrawal. The other one is the social consequences tend to be much greater with chemical dependence. And chemical abuse, patients don't have the same severity of social consequences, and they they don't meet criteria for physiologic dependence and tolerance.
One of the things that I've noticed, and I'm 53 years old, so I've been around for a while. Societies or the drugs of choice have changed over the years. If you look back 100 years, about 100 years, the favorite drug was opium. The Sherlock Holmes would hang out in opium dens. In the 60s, it was heroin. I don't hear very much about heroin anymore. Is it still a prevalent drug?
In the population that I treat, which is generally patients with either private pay funds or insurance, either their spouse or their mother or father or themselves are employed, I see very little heroin. I actually admitted a patient today with heroin dependence, and when I see it, I'm generally surprised. And I think that's for a few different reasons. One is that as we've become more sophisticated in terms of industry, we've been able to manufacture more and more potent drugs synthetically, and so you need less of the drug. The other thing is that we're manufacturing pharmaceutically so many pure drugs that it's easier to get access to those substances.
Right. But let's talk about the economic impact of drugs. And really, this is a bit of a double-edged sword. There's an economic impact in that if people are high, if you will, they're probably not working to their full capacity.
That's correct.
But there's also the economic impact on the black economy, if you will. And I don't mean that in a racial fashion.
Sure.
But, what I mean is that drug money is a significant part of the economy of the U.S.
Sure is.
Yeah, I can't answer to that. I really am not involved on that side. What I can tell you is that it's probably unmeasurable how much drugs and alcohol impact our economy in either a positive way on the black market, like you spoke about, or in a negative way. Although I have to say there's very little positive that comes from a black market, because in the end it always ends up, in my opinion, in greater cost. Either it's medical or through the criminal justice system, that type of thing. So whatever stimulation to the economy that has, I think, is much less than, and the detriment of that far outweighs it. But it's unmeasurable, because when you're in a family system or an employer system or a community system, and one person in that system or a few people are using, it affects everybody else in that system. So, you're up all night arguing with your spouse can't go to work either. DUIs, damage to property, the criminal justice system, missed days from work. I really think it's unmeasurable, but it certainly has an enormous impact.
Right. I was watching television last night, something I really don't do very often, and I came across a documentary about meth, and I'm horrified at how easy it is to make. Sure, you can close the borders and maybe keep some of the cocaine and marijuana out, but here's an addictive substance that you can just brew up in your kitchen. I mean, it doesn't seem to take many skills, and the raw materials are pretty much available over the counter. Is meth a problem in Florida, in Jacksonville?
Certainly we see crystal methamphetamine addiction. It's less of an issue in the Southeast than it is in the Midwest and the Western states. It tends to be more prevalent there. In terms of manufacturing crystal methamphetamine, the DEA has really made an attempt, and I think they've had some success in cutting down the production, because one of the easiest ways to produce it is using a precursor called ephedrine. Ephedrine was an over-the-counter substance, and by adding certain compounds to that, you can manufacture meth. It's extremely dangerous. You've heard of meth labs exploding. That's based on the process of using nitrogen-based compounds to manufacture the meth. And I think what we're seeing is this somewhat of a shift, and it's a slow shift of meth being produced outside of our borders and brought in to the country rather than being produced here to at this point, really very serious penalties for manufacturing meth, and also now a diversion program for ephedrine. You can't go in and buy 50 boxes of ephedrine at a commercial pharmacy like you used to be able to. It is behind the counter. You do have to speak with the pharmacist. They've recently developed several laws regarding that. The other thing I will say about crystal methamphetamine is it's tremendously addictive. Once you start using it, your body has a significant drive to continue utilizing that drug, and people will use it for many days on end without sleeping and develop multiple medical consequences from that.
Right. Let's take a caller. We have someone coming in from the 619 area code. What's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
My name is Marisela and I'm calling from San Diego, California.
Hi, Marisela.
Beautiful
hi.
Place.
Yes, it is. Actually, over here, it was a huge problem with the meth and everything, and that seems to have subsided, at least for a little while. You know, now it's more about the prescription drugs and Oxycontin. And my friend, who is really into, or you know, he's an addict of methamphetamine, it's hard for him to get off of it. And I don't know, like, if he's ever going to be fully recovered or anything, but now his son is addicted to Oxycontin, and he smokes those to a point where he nearly died.
Mm-hmm. From an overdosage.
Yes.
Well, I would say having a supportive friend like you is something very important. What attempts has your friend made to get sober?
First of all, he's going to his meetings, but those are mandated because he's on parole.
Uh-huh.
You know, he's trying to find a steady job, has something to work for. But I just, you know, there's only so much I can do. You know, me and him, we actually were boyfriend and girlfriend, but I just don't want to even go down that route anymore with him.
Right, and I think this is a good example of what we were speaking about earlier, about how an addicted person in a community system affects other people. It has affected your relationship. I don't know if your friend has access to be able to secure private treatment, but I would certainly recommend if he doesn't that he look into getting some type of public treatment.
Yeah.
It's a little more difficult to get treatment if the drug of choice is methamphetamine versus alcohol or benzodiazepines, but it still is out there. It's available.
Yeah.
What would the medical treatment be for meth? Is there something equivalent to methadone?
There's really not. There's some research out there that a drug called baclofen, which is a prescription drug, it's not a controlled substance, it's used for muscle cramping, which is what it was initially manufactured for, can decrease cravings with meth. But I would say that there's three things we would do. One is medically, if the person has any medical problems, either caused by or unrelated to the methamphetamine addiction, we would treat that. We would also evaluate the patient and make sure that there are no psychiatric comorbidity that we're dealing with. My guess is it sounds like there may be with this patient based on multiple attempts with your ex-boyfriend, multiple attempts to get sober and psychiatric medications. And then the other is going to be a lot of therapy. Follow through.
Does that answer your
question? Oh, yeah. Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye.
We have someone asking a question in the chat room. What about marijuana? Are you for or against its use for medical reasons?
I would. My opinion about that is I certainly would say that if marijuana is used for a medical purpose, it's prescribed by a medical doctor, and it's monitored that, you know, any medication that is used for a medical purpose and doesn't cause a lot of side effects is appropriate. I guess what we're talking about is either nausea from chemotherapy or it does increase appetite in cancer and HIV patients. The substance, tetrahydrocannabinol, is THC, is also manufactured in a pill form pharmaceutically, and it is available, and it is able to be prescribed. There are reports from patients that have smoked marijuana as well as taken the tablet form that the tablet form doesn't seem to have the same anti-nausea and appetite stimulant effects that it does with smoking the marijuana.
Actually, the person that asked the question also went on to wonder, does it increase creativity?
People who, I don't have any specific research information I'm familiar with that. What I can say is that people who utilize marijuana oftentimes feel that it does. But on the other hand, people who use any type of drug and become intoxicated feel like the perception that they have is altered, and it's not really a good basis of reality of what's happening. What they're seeing and what they're perceiving and what their mind is telling them is something different than other people around them who are sober.
Right. I'm guessing here, and it is a bit of a wild guess, that this same person in the chat room just put two letters up, MS, and I'm guessing multiple sclerosis. Is marijuana something useful in MS cases?
That's kind of out of my area of expertise, and I don't have an answer for you.
Okay, let's move on to a really hard question, and I showed my wife the question. She said, "Oh, that's a cracker." Running a treatment center must put you in a bit of a moral dilemma. You see the damage that drugs do. What do you do when or if a patient mentions a dealer's name? I mean, are you able to get that information to law enforcement, or is that part of a patient-doctor privilege?
Well, I know this has a lot of ethical concerns regarding this question, and it's probably why your wife said it was going to be a difficult one to answer, but actually for me it's very easy to answer. I'm in the medical profession. I'm not in the criminal justice system. And there are a lot of laws in each state and also on the federal level that protect patients who come in for treatment. So my first duty is to take care of that patient and protect their confidentiality. My second duty is if we have a patient who is threatening imminent harm to themselves or to another person, then I do have a duty to report that. Barring that, I have a duty to protect my patient's confidentiality, and it's really for a very good reason. If a patient comes into treatment and they're not able to get treatment confidentially, it really could deter a lot of people from coming into treatment.
Oh, I agree with what you're saying. I'm going to come back to that. Let's take another caller. We have someone coming in from the 978 area code. Hello, caller. What's your name and what's your question or comment for us?
Yeah, this is Richard, and I wanted to ask. My personal expertise is with heavy metal poisoning, and I've read two different studies, one pertaining to mercury and another one pertaining to manganese, that with an overdose of either one of those, the psychological profile creates a deficit, and the deficit requires some substitution. A lot of people use alcohol. Some will smoke heavily. It even gets into sex and criminal behavior, like kleptomania or stuff. Would you subscribe to something like that, or do you ever check your patients for heavy metal poisoning?
We don't specifically check our patients for heavy metal poisoning. If there are some signs or symptoms of that, certainly we would then, as a differential diagnosis, look at that. What I can tell you is that mercury and manganese are both neurotoxic substances in the appropriate level. And when you have, meaning that damaging to neurons, when you have a substance like that in your body, obviously you can develop some type of psychiatric, psychological, cognitive dysfunction. I've not read any reports, anecdotal or otherwise, that would condone prescribing any type of mood-altering substance for any of those disorders.
Well, the one for mercury was done by a guy named Sybil Root. He's in Arizona, I believe. The other one for manganese was done out of the Pfeiffer Treatment Center in Illinois, in case you're interested.
Okay. I appreciate the information. I'll look into it.
Okay.
Great. Thank you for your question.
You are.
We were talking about this moral dilemma of, knowing information and not being able to forward it. You gave us your professional opinion, the reason why. What about your personal opinion? This must eat you alive.
Yeah, I've had some cases where it's difficult knowing about, and I have to back up. The thing I also didn't mention when I talked about imminent harm to self or others, child abuse, elder abuse is also included in that.
Right.
I would say for me personally, and not professionally, that the most difficult cases to deal with are somebody who comes into treatment and has in the past abused another person, especially people who can't take care of themselves, such as children or adults, sexual predators, that type of thing. But when you're treating a patient, whether it be for a medical disease, psychiatric or chemical dependence, you have to be non-judgmental. You've got to walk into the room and understand that that person needs help and do your best to help the person regardless, without judging the person. And I really think that's the only way that you can provide optimum care is to walk into the room and not judge patients.
Right. In fact, what sort of relationship does a treatment center have with law enforcement? Are you kind of a no man's land, if you will, a neutral territory?
Actually, I think law enforcement depends on treatment centers, and treatment centers mutually depend on law enforcement for many reasons. Some of our patients end up in treatment because they've had contact with law enforcement. Law enforcement also helps us transport patients, and certainly when we have other issues. But in general, no, we don't have a specific defined relationship with law enforcement.
Right. I mean, you mutually coexist.
That's right.
I think
we depend on each other. They have less people to arrest if we treat patients. On the other hand, when patients get arrested, they oftentimes seek treatment.
Right. Does the crime merit the time?
Can you define what you mean by that?
Oh, okay. I read a lot of news every day, and inevitably I come across news articles about someone committing a murder, and they're sentenced to however many years, and 3 or 4 years later they're back on the streets. I hear about someone getting busted for the third time for oftentimes a relatively minor drug offense, and ending up behind bars for a very long time.
Sure. What I have to say is that I have to depend on our criminal justice system and court system and the laws that govern our society to make those judgment calls. Certainly not every case goes before the same jury, and not every case goes before the same judge. Different states have different laws. So oftentimes you see crimes that individuals think vary in terms of severity, but something that's perceived as less severe ends up getting a longer sentence, a longer incarceration, and I think it has a lot of variables in that. One is the state that you're in, or whether it's a federal, the judge that you go before, the attorneys that you have, a lot of variables in that.
Armando, once again, you've been very quiet.
I'm listening in. I'm trying to do a few things at the same time, but I actually have a comment, you know, to do a complete 180 on this and actually go back to what you were speaking about, Dr. Provines, of process addiction. I have two teenage boys, and I can't get them off their Xbox, and their video gaming habits have gotten, you know, I guess pretty bad. So, I mean, my question is, what extensive effect can that have on them as far as video game addiction?
It can have some consequences, such as lack of physical exercise, not doing your homework, and things like that. I can say that video games have a contrary effect on children. One of them is that they're beneficial in terms of developing muscle coordination, eye muscle coordination, that type of thing, and keeping the child stimulated, or even adult. But anything in excess ends up being detrimental in the long run.
But there's been a couple of court cases of young, I won't call them children, but young adults committing crimes, and particularly murder, and video games have been the defense, if you will. You know, they play all these single person shooter games, and you know, it was just an extension of the video game.
Mm-hmm. My opinion, and again, it's a personal opinion on that matter, and I'm sure many people have a different opinion, is that this has been around as long as we started making movies.
And radio,
and you know, I certainly, when I was young, watched Friday the 13th, and I've not committed any crimes. And most people do. I think it, if you have a psychiatric condition, or your home isn't supportive, or any social concerns, that it can develop into something that's not good. But overwhelmingly, many people are able to responsibly manage watching movies, listening to the radio, playing video games.
Right.
But again, anything in excess in the end ends up being pathologic or detrimental.
A subject that you touched on earlier on is the whole doctor shopping scenario. You mentioned that a number of states now, all of the pharmacies are linked together. And so there is a way to track multiple prescription abuse. Is there a way to actually attack it at the doctor level as well?
Yeah, many cases out there of physicians prescribing medications that aren't medically necessary, namely addictive medications. And so I would advise everyone to be careful when you go to your physician and question what they're prescribing and why. In terms of doctor shopping, it's oftentimes very difficult for the physician to determine that, because if you're prescribing OxyContin for a patient and the patient's being prescribed OxyContin by another physician, and the patient doesn't tell you, and you do a drug test and they test positive for OxyContin, which is the drug you're prescribing, it becomes difficult to determine that. I would say that it's easier to determine that if you do a very good history on the patient, obviously physical exam, but history. One of the other things that I think is important is speaking with the family, because oftentimes not only does the family have the information, but they're more willing to disclose the information than the patient.
Right. I'm not asking this question of you professionally, just personally. You look at the Michael Jackson scenario. I'm horrified. I'm horrified that someone that went to school for many years to learn the science of being a doctor might, and I'm not saying he did because he hasn't been hasn't been convicted, might abuse his position. What's your view?
Again, it's a very personal view, but my view on that situation specifically is that, number one, sometimes having a lot of money isn't the best thing that you can have, and in the end, it can lead to something like this. I know Michael Jackson certainly had funds to pay. On the one hand, I'm sympathetic to the physician for getting caught up in this situation. I think when you start, you don't think it's going to end up being that, and you get caught in a situation, and it escalates, and you continue to participate. But on the other hand, I do think that physicians take an oath to, first of all, cause no harm, and certainly harm was caused in this case. At some point, as a physician, you have to be able to walk away, even though your salary and your livelihood depends on that. The other thing I'll say is that when patients are in charge of their own treatment, people go to medical school for a reason, and patients go to see a physician for a reason. And although I think most professionals would encourage patient participation in treatment planning and the selection of medications, that at some point the professional judgment has to be able to override the wants and desires of the patient. And an example of that is I did experience a patient that came into our facility who was addicted to crystal methamphetamine and was also prescribed an amphetamine for ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And the patient was unwilling to come off of that medication. The patient threatened to leave the facility if they didn't receive the medication, and we had to let the patient go. To bring a patient in to detox or get treatment for a substance and then keep them on the substance really ethically and medically doesn't help the person. So that's an example of at some point the professional opinion has to be able to override any other personal opinion.
Right.
How dangerous is the drug propofol if abused? Because that was the drug that supposedly, the main drug that killed Michael Jackson.
Yeah, what I can say about propofol is it's an anesthetic drug. It's a barbiturate-like substance. It's used to induce and maintain conscious sedation as well as general anesthesia, and also to maintain sedation in an ICU. I've not heard of propofol ever being used medically outside of that type of setting. And so even to have access to that substance in someone's home is concerning. I know you're referring to the Michael Jackson case. When propofol was first manufactured, it was not a controlled substance. And when the DEA and professionals who use it became aware that it was being abused and becoming addictive, it was made a controlled substance. So the access to that drug was limited, but it certainly has been abused. It's generally abused by people in the medical field because it's not something that you have access to on the street. So nurses, doctors, that type of thing. And when the medical community saw that happening, they did put a control on the substance.
Anesthesiology is one of your specialities, is it not?
It is. It is.
Oh, splendid! All right, let's talk more about propofol then. But addictive in what fashion? Right? As far as I can see, there is no high to be gained. It just induces sleep.
Well, that's not exactly true. Every substance that someone takes has a gradient of effect, and if you take a high enough dose of propofol, it certainly will induce unconsciousness. if you're using small doses of propofol, it can induce a euphoric effect, much like a barbiturate or a benzodiazepine. So the person using that, although they may have amnesia, will be awake and functioning, and the receptors that the medication binds to in the central nervous system tend to be stimulated by that, and it creates an addictive cycle. So again, it depends on if you're using one or two cc's or milliliters of that, or if you're using 20.
Right. I've got to admit that in all of the Michael Jackson coverage, that is the first time that I have heard about any kind of euphoric effect. I was under the assumption that it really was just a form of knockout drop. Mm-hmm. Take this,
no.
And we'll see you tomorrow.
It depends on the dose. The difficulty with abusing propofol is it has a very, very quick, and we talked earlier about a half-life, meaning that the duration of action is very limited, so it's a medication or drug, depending on how you're using it, that you have to use every few minutes to maintain an effect. It's a difficult drug to use in that regard.
Is it something that you would administer using one of those little drip machines?
Well, in the anesthetic setting, either in the OR, ICU, that type of thing, yes, we certainly use drips. I'm not convinced that that's how people abuse propofol when they're abusing it, but certainly in the case that we're talking about, to maintain sleep, you would need to have a constant drip of the medication in order to have a continuous effect. Otherwise, you're injecting the patient every few minutes.
Mm.
In your personal opinion, you think Michael Jackson was abusing it?
Just by definition of the case, it was being misused. It's not indicated for insomnia, which is what it appears
right.
from news reports that he was using it for, and it was a habitual use.
Right, because he was begging, from what I heard, begging for it to his physician.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, I don't know his medical background.
Right.
I don't have access to the records, but certainly it sounds like something that could have been an addiction.
Okay, I think we've had enough of Michael Jackson. Michael's had his 15 minutes of fame on Blogger News.
Have we? We've not discussed HIV or hepatitis
right, that
B,
was
which I know.
Actually going to be my next thing, because from what I hear, it's actually becoming a huge thing. 30% of new cases that I've heard here in the U.S. can be traced to syringes, sharing syringes by drug users.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if that prevalence is up from years ago. What I do know is because of the method of transmission of the virus, it's a bloodborne illness, so certainly sharing syringes is one of the ways that people transmit the disease. What I can tell you is that with the increase in using prescription drugs, I'm seeing much less injection IV drug users in the facility than I did in the past, which certainly could lead to a decrease. But I think many people don't understand that snorting a drug and sharing a straw or a spoon or whatever you're snorting off of from one person to the next, if you have a damaged mucosa in your nose and there's blood there and you share it with another person, you can certainly contract HIV in that way. So just by sharing straws for snorting drugs, you can contract it. But the other virus that we are seeing an increase in is hepatitis C. And hepatitis C is transmitted in the same ways that HIV is, but I think it's easier to contract through sharing a straw than HIV.
Can, again, in a non-clinical aspect, there's hepatitis A, B, and C. Can you give us a quick lowdown on what we're talking about?
Sure. Hepatitis A is a virus that's transmitted from fecal material and typically is a virus that you get in areas or countries that don't have good sanitation. It's self-limited. It does cause inflammation of the liver. You can get jaundice, meaning yellowing of the skin and eyes from that. It can be severe, but most cases are mild, and it's not chronic. Hepatitis B is a chronic hepatitis virus. You can carry it. There is a vaccine available for hepatitis V. You have to have a series of 3 injections. I would encourage everyone to get that. It's oftentimes transmitted by saliva. It can be sexually transmitted as well. And once you get it, you can either be a carrier or you can have a chronic active disease. And then there's hepatitis C, which is transmitted in the same ways that HIV is, and it tends to be more severe, chronic, and oftentimes life-threatening. Hepatitis C does have treatments available. One of them is a drug called interferon, or Pegasus also, and it's often a difficult treatment. It goes on for a period of many weeks, and the patient has symptoms of flu-like symptoms during the treatment. If the interferon is effective, it may be effective for a period of time, and the patient may have a relapse with an increase in the hepatitis C virus.
Interferon, wasn't that originally introduced as an AIDS drug?
I don't know if it was originally introduced over that. I do know that it allows us to manipulate the immune system. And when you have a virus like a cold virus or the flu, so many of the symptoms are not caused by the virus itself, but they're caused by your immune system's reaction to that virus. And interferon allows us to manipulate the immune system in order to decrease the number of hepatitis C viruses that the person is carrying.
Actually, you mentioned flu-like symptoms, and I'm getting way off course here. Much has been talked about this swine flu. Any thoughts on that? I know this is way outside of addictions.
Yeah, many people don't think of influenza as being a medically consequential disease because everybody knows, either yourself or the neighbor or somebody who's had influenza A in the past, and you have the symptoms and they go away. But it is a significant contributor to morbidity and mortality worldwide. More likely in older or younger patients, but certainly at any age it can cause death. And the swine flu is another type, another version of that. It's transmitted in the same ways that regular flu is, but it tends to cause more severe symptoms, and it's certainly led to more deaths than other types of, or other strains of flu have in the past. I think that the surveillance system that we have with the CDC, the local health departments, and medical professionals need to work together to try to prevent the spread of it. And certainly we are going to see cases of H1N1 in the coming months.
Right. I mean, right now we're, you know, almost at the end of summer. I'm guessing October, November, we're going to start seeing a big increase.
Well, I can tell you many states right now have current cases of H1N1, and in our facilities we're being extremely vigilant at this point with any staff or patients who have any symptoms that are related to symptoms that a person can have when they have flu.
Actually, before we went on air, I was talking to one of our writers at Blogger News. He's a teacher's aide, I think somewhere in Texas.
Uh-huh.
And he was saying that already, you know, that they're seeing a trend upward of an increase in, you know, children missing school because of flu, and there have certainly been some cases of H1N1 reported.
Yeah. Right, and a piece of that could be that people are being extra vigilant. So at the first sign of it could be what's known as a common cold, and actually not the flu. I think people are more likely to be cautious, and if they hear of anything happening in a communal environment where people are in close contact, they're more likely to not participate in that activity.
Right. I'm going to go back to drugs.
Actually, real quick, Dr. Provine, is there a 1-800 number or a hotline to perhaps one of your facilities for listeners that have family members or friends that are addicted to drugs that can perhaps call in?
Yes, we have a 24-hour helpline, and I am going to put out the number. You can reach us at 1-800-511-9225. Again, that's our helpline. If you have questions, concerns, if you have someone in need of help, or if you're in need of help yourself, we do have another number I can give you. It's 1-800-730-7549, and that'll also get you to our helpline.
Actually, can I ask a favor? Could you possibly email those numbers to me, and I'll make sure that I put them in my article about this show that we've had today.
Absolutely.
Great. In fact, Armando, for once, actually stole my next question. Well, kind of, sort of. I was going to ask, you know, if people are listening in, and they may not necessarily have the financial resources to, you know, go through a private clinic, what would the advice be to the wife, the son, the mother, the father, you know, who needs to talk to someone, needs to get someone in their family some help?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing I'll say is they can certainly call our helpline. We receive around 30,000 calls a month, and most of those patients don't go to treatment. Most of the callers don't go to treatment. Some of them aren't in need of treatment. We can refer the caller to the appropriate resource. The other thing is, the person can look at local options for state-funded help. They can call their insurance company. They can look online or call Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous. There is, it's called CMA, Crystal Methamphetamine Anonymous, and look for help in those regards. If you have a physician, I would recommend you speak with your physician about the problem, and hopefully your physician also can assist you in getting help.
We're just about out of time here, but Armando, do you have any more questions?
No more questions. I think Dr. Provine, you've covered everything. Thank you very much.
Yes, I really want to thank Dr. Michael Provine for taking time out to talk to us this afternoon. It has been an illuminating conversation, that there are so many different aspects to the war on drugs. In fact, last question for you, Doctor. Are we winning the war on drugs?
Again, I think the war on drugs isn't a war that's going to have a defined start time and end time. I think it's going to be a continuous thing, and certainly we're winning some battles in terms of winning the war. I don't know that that's happened. And, you know, after you fight certain addictions in the future, I'm sure there are addictions that are going to come out, whether it's a chemical or a process addiction, that we don't have any idea that it's on its way. So I think it's a continuous battle. But I would like to say that if you're suffering from an alcohol or drug dependence or process dependence, you don't have to suffer. You can get treatment. There are things available. It's about being willing to get that help and knowing that help is out there.
What is going to be the next wave?
The next wave of addiction? I guess I'll have to wait and see.
Okay, you're not seeing anything that's suddenly occurring?
No, I think the most recent addictions that weren't expected were internet and video game. You know, chemical dependence has been a disease for hundreds, if not thousands, of years.
Okay, we're down to about 30 seconds here, so I have to wrap the show up. Armando, thank you so much for joining us today. And Dr. Michael Provence, thank you so much. And I do hope that we'll be able to talk again in the future.
Okay, thank you for the opportunity.
Pleasure as always.
This is Simon Barrett for Blogger News Network, wishing everyone a wonderful Saturday, and we will talk again soon. Goodbye.